Today on the 21st, testing for the coronavirus, once strictly rationed, is now freely available in most of Illinois. We'll talk to an infectious disease specialist about who should get tested, when you should seek a test, and the false confidence of a negative test result.
So negative test may not always mean negative, and it may not always be safe to do what you were doing in the pre-COVID times without actually weighing all these possibilities.
Then there's been a lot of talk lately about Antifa, short for anti-fascist, with false rumors of Antifa-led violence taking hold right here in Illinois. A conversation about what Antifa is and what it isn't. I'm Brian Mackey, that plus a conversation on summer bugs, all coming up on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL Urbana, WUIS Springfield, WGLT Normal, WCBU Peoria, and WNIJ DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Early in the coronavirus pandemic, testing for the COVID-19 illness was limited. Only people showing symptoms or traveling to the U.S. from certain regions of the world were likely to get the nasal swab showing they were positive or negative. Months later, that's changed, and testing is widely available in Illinois. Now, sites throughout the state offer free testing to anyone, regardless of whether or not they have symptoms or have been in contact with someone known to have the virus. But testing negative for COVID-19 doesn't necessarily mean you can't pass the virus on to others or that you should go back to your pre-pandemic life. Here to help us understand more about COVID-19 testing and what it can and cannot tell us is Dr. Vidya Sundaresan. She's Program Director for the Infectious Diseases Fellowship Program and co-chief in the Division of Infectious Diseases at SIU Medicine in Springfield. Dr. Sundaresan, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So Illinois now has free testing open to anyone, regardless of whether or not they have symptoms or know someone who's tested positive. Is there a case for everyone getting tested now?
It is a good thing that we have testing that's widely available. But it may not be a good idea for everybody to get tested. The reason for that is we are definitely needing tests to be done for, in some settings, more than once. In some settings, probably every 14 days, particularly in the congregate settings, etc. There's also tests that have been done for determining if it is safe for someone to return back to work. Testing is also useful in some settings where students, especially if it involves travel. So in situations like that, testing is definitely useful and widely available testing is helpful. But like you were mentioning earlier, this actually involves a little bit more than just having a positive or a negative test. It has to be interpreted correctly. And a negative test may not always mean that the virus is not present. There are so many reasons why we could get a false negative test, which involves the type of test that is done, the timing of the test, how the specimen was collected. So there are lots of things that have to be done correctly, and the test needs to be interpreted in a correct way.
Yeah, so the interpretation is key, I guess. Many people have been gathering at protests in Illinois in the past few weeks. Others maybe have been enjoying going to restaurants and eating outside, at least, as most of the state is in phase three. Let's say someone was out and worries that they might have been exposed. When is the ideal time to get tested?
That's a great question. So we have tried to see what the optimal timing for testing is. When is it that the virus concentrates maximally? So there's a good yield when the specimen is collected. These are tests where we are trying to go all the way to the back of the nose to get a good sample for testing. And if the virus is in high enough numbers, the chances that this test is positive are much higher. So anywhere from day 3 to day 7, the virus concentrates pretty highly in the back of the nose or the nasopharynx, as we refer to it. So that time frame is generally pretty good. CDC has also given recommendations for testing as well. Day 4 is what a lot of the information says is good. Day 4 after being in any mass gatherings, day 4 after that, the yield is most.
Is the testing process still involve that swab that I've heard people describe? It feels like their brain is being scraped way in the back of the of the nasal cavity there, or is it changed somewhat since then?
Unfortunately not. The nasal pharynx, which is swabbed, is still not a very comfortable test. So the swab, a flexible swab, is introduced through the nares and taken all the way to the back of the nose. And that's a comfortable feeling. And to actually improve the yield, that has to be twirled around for about 10 to 15 seconds to make sure that the virus is collected from the secretions there in the nasal pharynx or the back of the nose. So that's one type of testing. We do have tests which are available from the nasal cavity. So just your nares or a nasal test. You don't have to go all the way to the back of the nose there to the nasal pharynx. And those tests are also available. And we also have saliva tests. The problem with these tests, the false negative rates can be pretty high. So we know about the nasal test, and that, in fact, the false negative rates can be as high as about 15%. And the saliva tests, depending on the type of test, depending on what make it is, the sensitivity and the specificity can vary as well. So FDA has also approved home kits. And these can be saliva tests or just the nasal tests. And these don't necessarily have a lot of accuracy, and the safety is also of concern. So these are the tests that we have available. The nasopharynx, we used to collect specimens from an oropharynx route to where you could go straight from the mouth to the back of the throat. They are also accurate, but not as accurate as the nasopharyngeal tests. And then the nasal and the saliva tests are even less accurate.
Wow. So it sounds like, let's say you get your results back, you're negative for COVID-19, does that mean that you can go visit grandma that day or go back to work? Or do you want to maybe take a different approach?
So again, a negative test may not always mean negative for COVID. It depends on how the specimen was collected, what type of test was used. If the specimen was not corrected accurately, then the chances of false negatives increase. Also, the timing of the test. If somebody goes too soon after being exposed to get this test, we may not have enough virus in the back of the throat or any of the methods that are being used to be able to get a positive test. So this has to be taken in the context of when the exposure occurred, if somebody is asymptomatic, why is the test being done? Is it for return to work? And some of the other clinical features there too. Were there any symptoms in the past? 2 weeks ago, did this person have any symptoms? So a lot of questions that go along with getting a test. So a negative test may not always mean negative, and it may not always be safe to do what you're doing or what you were doing in the pre-COVID times without actually weighing all these possibilities.
And I think I've read that it's possible to test negative for the virus and not have any symptoms, but still spread the virus potentially to other people. Is that right?
Correct. So that's where, testing widely does help. So far, we have not really tested that many people who have been asymptomatic. So having that information is definitely useful from an epidemiological standpoint, where we are able to better estimate what the denominator is. We know now that about 50 to 60 or even higher a number of people with COVID can be asymptomatic. So it does definitely help us estimate that better. But there are also now, recent studies looking at what exactly are the possibilities? If somebody is asymptomatic, the risk of shedding virus and the risk of spreading it to somebody else, is that the same as somebody that is symptomatic? So we're looking into more of that information. So yes, asymptomatic people can shed the virus. About 50 to 60% of people with COVID may not have symptoms at all and still harbor the virus. But again, the implications of those, how likely are they to spread, et cetera, that the more information is coming out on that.
If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Dr. Vidya Sundaresan, who is Program Director in Infectious Diseases Fellowship Program and Co-Chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at SIU Medicine in Springfield. And Dr. Sundaresan, let's say that You test positive for the virus, but you have no symptoms. I mean, is it possible you were exposed previously and recovered? I think there's some confusion about we've heard about these antibody tests and, you know, the tests that are more widely available. Can you talk a little bit about the difference there?
Absolutely. That's a great question. And I should have clarified. A lot of what we were talking about earlier do refer to molecular tests or PCR tests, where we're looking directly at the viral particles. But there are also antibody tests available or a serology tests available, where, you know, we're looking at the response of the individual to the virus. The antibody tests are not yet widely available. And we're also looking to see how this can be best utilized. Studying to see how many people have the antibodies, how many people have immunity for COVID would be useful. But these antibody tests need to be very specific. They can be positive with exposure to any type of coronavirus, not just COVID-19. So it has to be very, very specific. So the way the test is constructed is very important there. We don't know how long people have immunity to COVID if they are exposed. And if these antibodies are tested, maybe about 6 weeks down or 2 months or 3 months, how long do these antibodies actually last and how long are they protective? And we don't know what is a protective titer. What exactly is the quantification on these? We know higher antibodies are good. They're more protective, but exactly what is the cutoff? Where exactly do we get protected? So all these answers we're still looking for and coming up with guidelines for antibody testing and how these can be best utilized. The antigen testing, which is what we're talking about, is widely available. And those are the types, the nasopharyngeal, the nasal specimen or saliva testing, oropharyngeal, and then these can also be done from bronchoscopy specimens.
Would you recommend that people be tested for the virus more than once, given what we were talking about earlier about the false negatives that come back?
If somebody is asymptomatic, then not necessarily. People have had more than one test. People have, in fact, had more than two tests. And this would be for somebody that's symptomatic and has had a negative test, but the suspicion for disease may be high and the timing may not have been optimal. The specimen collection methodology may not have been optimal and hence a negative test. So in situations like that, a repeat test would be useful. If somebody is asymptomatic, and again, the same principle applies, if there's a high risk for this individual, if they had contact with somebody that is positive for lab-confirmed COVID, in situations like that, if it's done really early, they had a negative test, do they need a repeat test again? So it really depends on the scenario and case-by-case basis where people may need more than one test. But it's not really necessary if somebody has a negative test to go back and get the test again because you don't believe the test or it may not have been accurate. In somebody that's asymptomatic, the chances of that happening is lower.
I wonder, what is the bottom line here? Who in Illinois right now should go get a test?
Somebody that has had a known contact with a COVID case, somebody that's in the healthcare setting and showing symptoms. And if there is a risk at all, they've been in mass gatherings, we're definitely recommending tests for anybody that's been in a gathering, a large gathering, and not having been socially distanced, not having worn masks. The risk may be higher in a situation like that. Although being outdoor versus indoor, the exposure, all those count as well. But definitely these situations, you want to get tested. But otherwise, if somebody has been asymptomatic at home, not that high of a risk factor, is prioritized lower.
You know, we've only got about a minute left in our conversation. Cases, the daily reported cases have come down statewide. I wonder if you're recommending that people take the same precautions they did before Illinois reached its peak, or at least its first peak, or do you think people can make some adjustments?
We have had a phased recovery process, which is great. Illinois is in the green, which shows that our numbers are not increasing. We're actually flattened or even going down. So we're in a good place now. Continuing to do what we are doing is essential. So we stay there till the recovery process is complete. So wearing masks, hand washing as much as possible, wiping down surfaces. If you're sick, stay home. Cover your sneezes. These are some of the things that we can continue to do. Socially distance, follow guidelines, recommendations that are in place right now. These public health measures do work. So we need to continue to do them till we have completely recovered.
Dr. Vidya Sundaresan is Program Director of the Infectious Disease Fellowship Program and the Co-Chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at SIU Medicine in Springfield. Dr. Sundaresan, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today on the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, a conversation about Antifa, short for anti-fascist, in the wake of the Trump administration's threat to designate Antifa as a terrorist organization. There have been false rumors of Antifa-led violence, some taking hold right here in small-town Illinois. We'll look at what Antifa is and what it isn't coming up after a break. If you want to join the conversation, our phone lines are open, 800-222-9455. The number again is 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us your comments and questions to @21stshow. That's @21stshow. And as ever, we'd love to hear your thoughts on what we talked about on the 21st. Send us an email, talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. More to come after a short break. This is the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. You may be hearing the word Antifa a lot lately, but how did being anti-fascist evolve into what the Trump administration is now threatening to designate as a terrorist organization? Is it even a centralized, organized group in the first place? In the wake of George Floyd's killing, as protests against racial injustice have erupted around the country, the Trump administration has been quick to lay the blame on this supposed shadowy dark group. You may have seen the president's tweet last week pushing the conspiracy theory that a 75-year-old man, Martin Gugino, was violently pushed by riot police in Buffalo, New York, and suffered a skull and brain injury, that he may have actually been, quote, an Antifa provocateur. And here's a clip from a May 30th speech where President Trump suggests that Antifa is to blame for the unrest.
The memory of George Floyd is being dishonored by rioters, looters, and anarchists. The violence and vandalism is being led by Antifa and other radical left-wing groups who are terrorizing the innocent, destroying jobs, hurting businesses, and burning down buildings.
Despite the president's claim, neither the FBI nor the Department of Homeland Security have come out with any intelligence to back up this assertion. And in the dozens of cases of individuals facing federal charges in connection with the protest, there's no mention at all in documents of any supposed Antifa links. One thing we do know is that the Trump administration's labeling of Antifa has had ripple effects all the way to Illinois, where hoaxes have spread and panic with in places like Sparta in Randolph County. Joining us now to discuss that and just what Antifa is and isn't are Russell Brandom, policy editor at The Verge, and Wes Enzina, who's a former senior editor at Mother Jones and former senior editor at Harper's as well. He's presently still a contributing editor there. Russell and Wes, thanks for joining us on the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
And thank listeners, you. We invite you to join our conversation. If you have a question for our guests about Antifa, give us a call. Phone lines are open at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Russell, I'm going to begin with you. The title of your recent article for The Verge says it all. Quote, Antifa bus hoaxes are spreading panic through small town America. Just what is and isn't Antifa, and how are small communities being threatened?
Yeah, well, I think, are they being threatened at all? I think, you know, what I describe in the piece is this sort of what you might think of as like a chain letter or a kind of really poorly sourced email. Because we're in 2020, it's largely happening on Facebook, that someone will say, you know, from a small community that maybe has not seen the kind of mass protests that we're seeing in major cities. And they'll say, you know, these provocateurs that you're seeing in the big cities are trying to bring trouble to our small town. There are busloads of them coming up this specific road, and they're going to appear at this specific place at this specific time. So, you know, lock your doors. And if you have some sort of weapon to protect yourself, now is a good time to get it out. And there's just, you know, we really haven't seen this happen, right? Like the idea that busloads full of sort of violent protesters are coming out to rural and suburban areas is just really not a thing that we've seen happen. But there have been, at this point, dozens of small scale, very targeted rumors that have often resulted in people, you know, getting really alarmed in those communities.
And Russell, the Trump administration, with the backing of Attorney General William Barr, has threatened to designate Antifa as a terrorist organization. And you heard that clip we just played where the president suggested Antifa was responsible for violence in protests. I mean, it seems to imply that there is some sort of, you know, organized, centralized organization with maybe a president and a treasurer, you know, membership cards. But I mean, how much of this is trying to give a name and a face to something that is, you know, sort of an invisible ideological enemy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big part of it. One of the common responses to that is that it's sort of like declaring bird watchers a terrorist organization. You know, you can sometimes there are organized groups of bird watchers, and you sort of know the kinds of things bird watchers do, but it's not really, there isn't like some sinister force coordinating all of them. I would also say, I mean, just to be clear, it is legally dicey to designate a domestic group a terrorist, or I mean, you know, independent of whether this is a group at all,
sure,
this question of whether this is in fact like a domestic political organization that you're cracking down on, and you know, what are the acts of terror that they've committed? I think there are real questions about all of that too.
You know, and it's interesting, I just to go back briefly to a moment ago when you mentioned bird watchers, I think that, so it's, think of it as like a lowercase now, not necessarily like we're capital, like I'm looking at my script here and the word Antifa is capitalized again and again, but what I hear you saying, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that this is just more of a descriptor for different groups, different individuals who may regard themselves as part of this idea that I've heard described as, you know, see a Nazi, punch a Nazi, right?
Yeah, I would say, you know, any large, so we're seeing mass protests, right? There are large groups of people who are taking to the streets, right? And I think any large group of people, you are going to have some people who are very concerned about, you know, keeping the disobedience civil and not, you know, destroying property, not sort of provoking violence, right? And you're also going to have people who are less concerned about that. That's just and you know, you can have a question of how controlled is this protest, how peaceful is it, but like just saying the 1% most rowdy people in this crew we're going to say are part of this sort of mysterious organization. Like, no, it's just people at protests who don't mind breaking things.
So, Wes, I want to bring you into the conversation and jump back in time a little bit. In 2017, you wrote an article for Mother Jones about an incident. This is, what, about 8 years ago, 2012? It happened in Tinley Park, which is a suburb of Chicago. Can you just real briefly tell us what happened there?
Sure. 18 members of a group called Anti-Racist Action, they attacked a bruncheon of white supremacists who were having brunch at a diner in Tinley Park. And they beat up this group of white supremacists with chair legs and nunchucks, and five of the members of Anti-Racist Action were caught and went to prison.
And I mean, were the people in this group, did they refer to themselves as Antifa, or do you, I mean, do you see them as somehow in line with this idea of the label Antifa that we've been hearing so much about?
Yeah, they would have definitely or definitely described themselves as Antifa. I mean, it's always worth pointing out Antifa just is a shortened version of anti-fascist. So, you know, the group that they were part of, Anti-Racist Action, in many ways is kind of the origin, the original American group of what we would think of as Antifa. They began in 1988 and grew out of a sort of earlier group called the Baldies, which was basically a multiracial street crew in Minneapolis who formed to fight neo-Nazis who had started to pop up, racist skinhead gangs who were going to concerts and intimidating people or stabbing people. And so the kind of modern iteration of Antifa happens in the 80s when you get an enormous, a big spike in white supremacist groups all over America. So it essentially emerged as kind of a defensive gesture. And Anti-Racist Action, which is now more or less dormant, is an organized group, was never probably, it's hard to estimate how many members they ever had. At most, they probably had 1,000. I would guess it was actually fewer than that. But because they engaged in street fights and that sort of thing, it's not entirely clear how many members they had. But so the five guys who I interviewed and spent a lot of time with who went to prison for the attack in Tinley Park, three of them were brothers. They had they were from Central Indiana. They had a black sister. They had experienced a lot of racism. They were working class guys, and they basically saw a lot of violence and thought that they basically became enchanted with this idea that you had to do something to stop white supremacists. And I mean, they embodied, I think, the sort of deeper Antifa ideology, such as there is a coherent one, which is that fascists and white supremacists and neo-Nazis don't typically respond to legal mechanisms, and you can't rely on those efforts or the police to prevent neo-Nazis from recruiting and organizing. And so there's a quote from an ARA member, Anti-Racist Action member, about how racism is an idea, but fascism is an idea mixed with action. And it took fascism to establish Jim Crow, and before that, slavery. It took fascism, anti-Semitism has been around a long time, but it took fascism to make the Holocaust. And the quote ends, "When you cross that threshold, you negate your rights to a calm, collective conversation."
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Wes Enzina. He's a former senior editor at Mother Jones and Harper's. He's a contributing editor at Harper's now, and he wrote a number of years ago about an attack in Tinley Park of anti-fascists against some white supremacists in a restaurant there. We're also speaking with Russell Brandom, who's a policy editor at The Verge and has been writing about Antifa hoaxes spreading panic in places like Sparta, Illinois. And want to remind our listeners, you can join our conversation at 800-222-9455. And we have a caller, Rebecca from Belvedere. Welcome to the 21st. And you, I understand, identify as Antifa. What does that mean to you?
Oh, I absolutely do. I'm a 65-year-old blue-haired grandma, and ever since the late 60s, early 70s, I have fought against any kind of oppression, whether it was military, political, racial prejudices, all of those things. I was around in Ann Arbor, Michigan back in the day when the SDS turned into a violent group, and of course, it was really scary. Most of us were peace protesters. We didn't want our friends dying in Vietnam anymore. And I'm currently watching, obviously, like everybody else from quarantine, with what is going on right now. And I cannot understand why anybody would agree with fascism. And to me, that is a default to being an anti-fascist or Antifa. They can label it. They can. It's a kind of an exciting sounding name. I think that don't use his name. 45 has capitalized on that as a obvious commercial ploy. And I am Antifa. I am. I refuse to watch society crumble and recreate what happened in Nazi Germany. I refuse to live through what my parents had to, being born in 1932 and 1937, as people who watched their German family. I'm one quarter German.
Sure.
So, I mean, I relate that way, but yeah. I also relate because I do not want my grandchildren to ever even have to deal with fascism. They don't seem to know what it is. Mm-hmm. Obviously, 45 doesn't know what it is.
All right. Well, Rebecca, thank you. Thank you so much for your call. We appreciate you sharing your views. And if anyone else wants to join the conversation, the number again is 800-222-9455. Russell, I want to sort of pivot off that question. I've thought about this because my grandfather was in World War II. He got some Nazi shrapnel in his leg. I'm pretty sure that at some point he would have identified as being anti-fascist, as I would imagine most people in the armed services in World War II would have. That message of what Antifa is has changed. And if we move, from that idea of it, of fighting the Nazis literally in World War II, to what these sort of email forwards or Facebook forwards that are happening now, can you tell us, Russell, what Sparta, Illinois, 2020, you've written about how an Antifa bus hoax caught the imagination of the community there. What happened?
Essentially this, and we've seen this in Oregon, we've seen this sort of across there was this single post on a website called DC Dirty Laundry, which I think is not super reputable, but if you've never heard of it, it might seem reputable. And there was this claim that they had discovered a plot to bus in large numbers of, quote, Antifa terrorists to Sparta, Illinois, where they will be directed, and here I'm quoting from the email, to target rural white Americans by burning farmhouses and killing livestock. And then it sort of names these specific routes that the bus will be taking, and is sort of sourcing all of this to highly reliable individuals. And it just, there seems to have been no reason to think that this was true. The sheriff of Sparta, Illinois ultimately said, we have no evidence leading us to believe that this threat is at all credible. And it really, we don't know where this came from, but I think the specificity of the rumor got a lot of people really worried. And I also think the fact that a lot of people, President Trump and various sort of institutions that support him have really been encouraging people to see, whatever you think of Antifa as being, they want you to think it's a threat, right? And so then when you see a hoax like this, a lot of people are really primed to see it as an immediate threat to them.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I first heard this, and I won't ask you to speculate on this, but Russian troll farm sort of sprang to my mind. I mean, if you Google Sparta, one of the big facilities that's there is the World Recreation Shooting Complex. I might have the acronym wrong, but it is known as a place where people with who are interested in guns come every year to congregate. In fact, it was just in the last week or so that the annual competition there has been canceled for this year, at least canceled there because of the pandemic. So, we've got less than a minute left. And Wes, I want to ask you, I wonder, do you see any connections between some of the organizations you reported on in the past, ARA, Anti-Racist Action, and the Hoosier Anti-Racist Movement, and this supposed, Antifa-led violence being postulated by our leaders today?
Yeah, I think it's the same group of people who are concerned about the rise of extreme racism in America and its continuing shift into the mainstream. I think also a thing to remember and a thing that connects the groups that I reported on that committed their attack in 2012 and the groups now is that since 9/11, 68 people have been murdered by white supremacists, but zero have been killed by Antifa since then. They've gotten in fist fights, they've beat people up, which many people fairly find abhorrent, myself included, but there's no Timothy McVeigh of the Antifa movement, there's no Dylan Roof, there's no James Field, the guy who murdered Heather Heyer in Charlottesville. According to the FBI themselves, there's no murders by Antifa. So I think the group and the idea makes a great boogeyman and distraction for Trump away from the real threat of right-wing violence that in many ways people think and he's stoked and encouraged. So
okay.
But they may engage in extreme tactics, but they're no murders.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Wes Enzina is a contributing editor at Harper's. We've also been speaking with Russell Brandom of The Verge. Thank you both so much for joining us. More 21st after a short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. When you hear the sound of this insect, summer probably comes to mind. Those are cicadas, of course, and they can actually generate as much noise as something else we often hear in the summer, a lawnmower. And this year, cicadas have emerged early. Here to tell us more about that is Christopher Dietrich, an entomologist at the Illinois Natural History Survey. Chris, thanks for coming on the 21st. Welcome.
My pleasure.
And in addition to cicadas, we couldn't talk about summer bugs without mentioning the mosquito, and one mosquito in particular, the so-called Asian tiger mosquito, which, in case you didn't have enough to worry about right now, is especially risky because of the diseases it carries and its ability to thrive in more difficult environments. It is making its way into Illinois. And to talk about that, Chris Stone is joining us. He's a medical entomologist, also at the Illinois Natural History Survey. Chris Stone, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And we have two Chris's on our segment today. We're going to try and differentiate. I might use your last names to help myself and our listeners keep that straight. And I want to remind our listeners, if you have questions for our insect experts, you can join our conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. So let's start with the cicadas, Chris Dietrich. What does the early emergence of the cicadas mean? I think it's tempting for people to think of the, pandemic and now protests we're seeing, and now there's this like horde of bugs coming out early. Imaginations are running wild. What is the significance of this early emergence?
Well, to be honest, we're not really sure. It's kind of a curious phenomenon. It occurs every once in a while. I mean, normally these cicadas emerge every 13 or 17 years in any particular area. But for whatever reason, they're coming out 4 years early this year. And so we're seeing large numbers up around the Chicago area, as well as some other pockets of them and farther south in Illinois. So I don't know what the answer is. The speculation is it has something to do with climate change or some other kind of environmental cues that are throwing them off. We don't really know for sure.
You mentioned that they're usually, 13 or 17 year cicadas?
Right.
That's in Illinois, but there's different sort of, I guess they're called broods. Can you talk about that difference
right.
and so process a little bit?
Periodical cicadas. These are periodical cicadas, and they're different from the annual cicadas that we see every year when you played a clip of the song of one of the annual cicadas early in the segment. But these actually have this really synchronized emergence every 13 or 17 years, and they're different broods, and we call them different broods because they come out in different parts of the country, different years, and so there's actually 15 different broods, 12 broods of 17-year cicadas, mostly distributed in the north, and then we have three broods of 13-year cicadas that are mostly southern in distribution. And so different parts of the country have these different broods that come out in different times. We actually have five different broods in Illinois that come out in different years. And just coincidentally, this year, what we're seeing is the northern brood, which is a 17-year brood, and then we're also seeing a 13-year brood, both of which were due out 4 years from now, but a lot of them seem to be coming out 4 years early.
Fascinating. All right, let's turn to the other big insect, or at least insect in this story, the Asian tiger mosquito. Chris Stone, what makes this mosquito distinct from other types of mosquitoes that we might be more familiar with?
Sure. So the really big difference, especially with mosquitoes in Illinois, is that this is a day-biting mosquito. It's active sort of early in the morning, late in the afternoon, And it's really aggressive and you know, bites humans, comes after us quite happily. So that's a bit different from some of the other mosquitoes that we have here in Illinois. So the main West Nile vector mosquito that transmits West Nile, for instance, tends to bite birds and only rarely bites us. And it's typically not the mosquito that people would complain about or notice even perhaps. This one is different. This is the one that actually interferes with you while you're enjoying your backyard or having your kids play outside.
And how did this, I understand that this mosquito has not always been in Illinois. Do we know how it got here?
Yeah, I mean, so that's it's a long story. So it came originally from, or originates in Southeast Asia, in these tropical and subtropical parts. And over centuries has sort of expanding, has been expanding its range there as human populations expanded as well. So it, what is unique about this mosquito as well is that it is capable of using any kind of container that you find around human houses to develop in. So it benefits from places where humans are. Over the past 30 to 40 years, it has really been undergoing a worldwide spread. And it's now present in Europe and Africa, Latin America, North America. And that is really because of international trade and globalization. And it's mostly the trade in ornamental bamboo on the one hand, but most importantly, we think, is the international trade in used tires. So it's thought that it was a shipment of these tires from Japan to Texas in 1985 that introduced it to the United States. And from there, it's been interstate shipments and local movements of tires that probably have moved it very quickly throughout the Southeast and then also to Illinois. So it's actually been in Illinois for close to 30 years, but it's always been in a very spotty distribution and at fairly low levels. And what we've been seeing now is we're seeing it almost anywhere in the southern and central parts, and it has become just much more abundant.
Interesting. This goes from a tire in Texas to Illinois. Fascinating. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Chris Stone, a medical entomologist at the Illinois Natural History Survey, and Chris Dietrich, also an entomologist at the Illinois Natural History Survey. And I want to turn out as sort of thinking about the effects that these insects have on us. And Chris Dietrich, when we're talking about cicadas, what are the risks to people potentially, but more so, I gather, to crops and plant life, just in general? And then is there any special risk because they emerged early this cycle?
Well, cicadas are all plant feeders, so they potentially could damage plants through feeding, just from removing the sap of the plants. Generally, they don't occur in large enough numbers to cause any significant damage. But as we're seeing with periodical cicadas, the mass emergences sometimes cause some damage to trees and shrubs just from the females actually laying their eggs and twigs. So when enough of the females actually lay the eggs in the twigs of these plants, they can cause the twigs to die back. So that can cause some damage, and it can actually kill a small tree if there are enough of them. Generally, they don't move into crops. These are mostly forest insects, and they mostly prefer to lay their eggs on trees because the imagers will then drop to the ground after they hatch and burrow into the soil where they feed on the roots of trees.
And is there any risk to people other than, you know, the chance that when I'm out biking and one of these things slams into my teeth that I scream like a small child? Is there any health risk?
Yeah, if you're riding a motorcycle and you happen to drive by an area where these are emerging and flying around, you could have one hit you in the eye if you're not wearing a helmet or something like that. But other than that, I wouldn't say they're dangerous.
Okay. And Chris Stone, what about the mosquitoes, these Asian tiger mosquitoes? Do they carry health risks that maybe are not, that we would not have seen in Illinois previously before these have become more persistent and widespread?
Right. So we know they, so in the lab, they can transmit just about any virus you throw at them. So they're highly competent for all kinds of viruses. The ones that it's associated with that are perhaps the most well known are these tropical viruses such as dengue and Zika and chikungunya is another one. And especially that last one, chikungunya, there have been outbreaks in Europe in places like Italy and islands in the Indian Ocean that were clearly solely because of this species. So we haven't seen transmission of any of those viruses here in Illinois yet, but it is something to sort of keep an eye on or be, you know, be cognizant of. And then there are also viruses that are just already present in the United States that this species does also transmit and can play a role in. And one of those is, it's not well known, but it's called La Crosse virus, which is actually the leading cause of encephalitis in children in the United States. I think more immediately, if you're thinking about sort of quality of life, this is because of how aggressive and abundant and right in your backyard this mosquito is. People have documented that children will play less or spend less time outside in areas where this mosquito is abundant, and just the general quality of life on your porch or backyard is going to be clearly affected by this species.
Hmm. Is there something, do the normal things that people do to protect themselves from mosquitoes, you know, bug spray, burning citronella candles, things like that, do they work on this particular species, or is it, you know, more impervious to that, to our normal tactics?
Yeah, so I think insect repellents, things like DEET, are definitely recommended. And, you know, we have small kids, and I've noticed since a few weeks we've had to start spraying them down, or they'll just come back covered in mosquito bites. And DEET works. What I have noticed is that because this mosquito is so aggressive, if you miss even a single spot on your body, they might just find that. So it I think it takes, you know, it is a very aggressive biter. The biggest thing you can probably do in your own backyard is make sure you don't have any containers of water sitting around that you're sort of that might be sitting around for a few days to a week where these mosquitoes can develop in. So carefully making sure to turn buckets over or tip water out is one way to keep the numbers down in your backyard.
And I wonder just briefly if you have an opinion on these services that I've seen advertisements cropping up for, where people come around with, you know, some sort of thing that looks like a bazooka and puffing smoke around the house once a month for a fee. Do you have an opinion about how or whether those are effective?
Not immediately sure. I know the product you're referring to.
Okay.
But one thing that people can do, if you're inclined to use pesticides, there are sort of what we call barrier treatments, so things you can apply on the vegetation in your yard. And those, I believe those will have an effect as well.
Interesting. Okay. And then, Chris Dietrich, I want to ask in just, you know, a couple of minutes left in our conversation today, you know, we've been talking about health risks from mosquitoes, and there are not necessarily health risks from cicadas if you're not, you know, hitting the head at high speed with one. But I wonder if the emergence of cicadas points to a climate risk. Do we have a sense? I think you mentioned earlier that that's, you know, a hypothesis about why they emerged early. I mean, can you talk about, you know, what people are postulating about why it might be related to climate change?
Well, they obviously use some sort of environmental cues to figure out which year it is and when to come out. You know, they're underground for 13 or 17 years as it matures, and then something has to trigger the emergence of the adult. And presumably, that's an environmental cue of some series of environmental cues, and we just aren't really sure what exactly is happening. But just in general, I think there's a lot of cause for concern with insects, not just cicadas. I mean, there have been a lot of studies recently that have shown there have been pretty severe declines of lots of different species of insects, including things like pollinators and things that we rely on, you know, that we don't really appreciate the roles that they play in the environment, but in sort of maintaining natural communities of plants, maintaining our crops, maintaining, you know, plant reproduction and so forth. And so it's not just the cicadas that we're seeing disturbing trends in. It's lots of different groups of insects.
Okay. And we're going to have to leave our conversation there. We have been speaking with Chris Dietrich of the Illinois Natural History Survey, as well as Chris Stone, a medical entomologist, also at the Illinois Natural History Survey. Chris and Chris, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your expertise on the 21st.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome.
And that is all the time we have for our show today. Coming up later this week on Thursday, we're going to be talking about some of the silver linings of quarantine. And we wonder what unexpected positive lessons, realizations, or maybe new habits you have formed during quarantine. Maybe if you're a better cook now or spent more time in nature. One of the easiest ways to connect with us is by text message. You can join Text the 21st by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. That's TALK to 217-803-0730. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.